Welcome to the first event in the fourth annual interim lecture series. Each interim, we have tried to schedule a special series of lectures on a single topic. And this year, our choice of Native American values was inspired by several things, one being that six courses on campus during this interim have as their special focus some topic related to Native American concerns. And secondly, St. Olaf College is attempting to establish a program where we as a campus community become more sensitive to the concerns and values and needs of the Native Americans with whom we live. As this began to develop, we discovered a wider interest in the Northfield community in these things, and with the cooperation of four other bodies in Northfield, the Northfield Bicentennial Committee, the Northfield Senior High Student Council, the Northfield Historical Association, and the Northfield City Library, St. Olaf College, with these groups, applied to the Minnesota Humanities Commission for a grant to help finance not only this interim series, but also a series of events in February, April, and May, all in the general topic, Native American values and the dominant American culture. Tonight's lecture is the very first event in this series, which we hope will stimulate thinking and discussion and action on the part of the whole Northfield community. You are receiving now a white questionnaire. As part of our obligations under this grant, we've been asked by the Minnesota Humanities Commission to try to ascertain the response of the Northfield and St. Olaf communities to the events that occur. So I'd appreciate it if you would fill this out by the time you leave the room and just leave them on the table by the door. I'll call your attention to the series of lectures which have been publicized in brochure on campus, this brochure, and in posters on campus and downtown Northfield. There will be 10 lectures in this series. The next one is tomorrow night in this place. They will all be right here. That will be Larry Martin. Next week on Monday, Pat Bellinger. On Tuesday, Paul Bow, who is a visiting professor on campus, and some of you may be in his course. On Thursday of next week, Artley Skenendor Jr. On Monday, the 19th of January, Professor Henry Fritz. On Tuesday, the 20th, Clyde Bellicourt. On Thursday, the 22nd, Laura Waterman Whitstock. And then the last week of interim, on Monday and Tuesday, Marie Funmaker and Ralph Ware. And we urge you to attend as many of these as you're able to attend. At this time, I'd like to call on Alan Strosheim, who is a student in one of the interim classes on Native American values, who will introduce tonight's speaker. Alan.
Mr. Poupart is a Ojibwa Indian from the Lac du Flambeau Indian Reservation in Rhinelander, Wisconsin. He's currently living in Minneapolis. He has a wide range of interests. In the past, he has been a Golden Gloves boxer. He won the regional title four times. And the American Indian Association of the United States still awards a John Poupart Sportsmanship Trophy for that. He has been elected to the Minnesota State Indian Affairs Commission. And he has established the Indian Offender Rehabilitation Project and worked as a program developer for the Department of Corrections in the state of Minnesota. Currently, he is the executive director of the Anishinaabe Longhouse, a halfway house for Indian offenders in the state of Minnesota. Tonight, Mr. Puppart will speak on the topic Native American Perspective, the several levels of justice. And I encourage you, if you have any questions, to feel free to ask him after his talk. Mr. Puppart?
Thank you for the welcome and the kind introduction. You know, it's very hard to focus in on your life when you know that you have a limited amount of time to talk to people, and when you've had 30 some years of learning, you have to draw from that into kind of refine it down into some meaningful words and comments, and some things that will stay with you and will have some substance to them. I wanted to expand upon the introduction which was given so that you can maybe identify or help, it'll help you identify with what and where and how I've been. I'm 36 years old. I've been off on the reservation for about 20 years. I left there as a very young boy at 13 years old. And I went out to find something. I'm not sure what I was looking for then. I still have not decided what I was looking for. But I left that Indian reservation and went to work as a pulp cutter, as a logger. I worked in some of the old lumber mills that you read about in the Paul Bunyan books, you know, about the cook shanties and the horses and mules and things they used to skid pulp with. Well, I was a part of that scene, and I learned a great deal from that. I was a fruit tramp, you know. I went up and down the seaboard of California, Oregon, and Washington. I also worked in Wisconsin and cherry picking, apple picking. I worked as a carnival worker, as a circus worker. And all of these things that came about taught me some things about life. I was never a logger twice. I was never a carnival worker twice, because those things I found were not the way to live. But I learned a great deal from them. And I suppose that brings me, you know, to the point of how did I become knowledgeable? How did I become educated? The education I have is a unique kind of education. How I got that education was a unique style of educating. And it's mostly through learning of trial and error. Trial and error brought me through the welfare system, first of all. Introduction, that was the introduction to the juvenile justice system, which caught me in its entanglement, which caused me to have three trips to the state training school at Red Wing. And I was there in 1955, 56, and 57. I'd go there every summer. It was like a summer camp to me, you know. I just kept going back, and people thought I liked it, you know. Where's Puppart? Oh, he's back there. Well, each time, because I played the game, and I learned that game the first time there, that if you tell a social worker what he wants to hear, he is worthwhile, and he's doing his job super. So he lets you go again, and then you come back. I wore out that school because I got too old for it. And finally, I went on to that, and I finally wound up in prison one time. I wound up in prison in 1965. Aggravated robbery. I was charged with aggravated robbery, and tried and convicted. And I served 4 years at the state prison at Stillwater. And there I learned many things about justice and how it develops, how it is meted out. And I noticed that a lot of my people were in there, the same people I saw in Red Wing, who were there in the state prison. And I was convinced that something was wrong with how we handle Indian people. I tried to be a non-Indian person many times. I tried that because the surroundings in the environment where I was at as an individual, and many times outnumbered, people would tell me that you ought to appreciate life as we do, that the things that we're prescribing for you are for your own welfare, for your own benefit, so that someday you'll be somebody great. Or, you know, every man can be a president. I wonder if that's true for the women. We have gone through so many of that, so much time wasting words like that on people, which are just full of holes. And the secret that I finally discovered was that I couldn't be white for a couple of reasons. First of all, my skin wouldn't let me pass as a white person. And the other portion of that was that people, while they were telling me that you could be white and you should be white, would never allow you to let that happen. You could never be white. So you are caught in the middle of a lie. That was my case. So I said, hey, I might as well drown my sorrow in drinking, you know. And I got into that whole negative style and wound up in jail. And it was during those years that I started putting things together. First of all, I finished high school, then I finished my printer's apprenticeship and realized that they didn't want me as a printer either, because I was over 25 years old and nobody would hire you unless you had union accreditation. So what good was your printing certificate if nobody would hire you and you was too old to go back to get the certificate? Again, I was caught in that same predicament that said you should be white, but we won't let you be white. I was very confused for a while, even in terms of my religion. I wanted to be a Catholic. I went to prison believing that I should be a Catholic. And I felt that if I went to Sunday school or if I went to church every day, that the administrators or whoever watches you, I didn't know where they were watching me from, but whoever watched you would take that into consideration and let you out of prison. Well, needless to say, it didn't do any good, because when I went to the parole board, they gave me 3 years to do. I did them. I try and take a look at the days or the weeks when things happen differently for me. And I guess it was just a sinking in of all the things that were around that finally said to me that I should be an Indian person. There should be no shame in that. There should be some joy in life. That's my personal kind of awakening of where I'm at today. Learning. Everybody needs an education. I'm not sure that all of us can get that education in a equal kind of way. But I want to talk about more a broader issue now. And the broader issue has to do with our justice in America. There is no justice in America. That's the first thing. There is no justice. I think any time that you can buy your way out of prison, I think any time that you can sell your fellow man so that you don't go to prison, and I think that any time you can manipulate the politics of this country and not go to prison or pay the fine or submit to any penalty, there is no justice. And when you find that, when you have that realization and you look at your own immediate surroundings, and me as a Native American, I look at Indian people, and it's clearly documented in whatever filing system you want to go to that Indian people are paying far more than any other ethnic group in the country for so-called breaking the law. We have 70 Indian people in prison at Stillwater. That's about 10% of the state population, the prison population. We have 55 Indian people at St. Cloud, and that's roughly 10% of that institution's population. And you look at our small numbers in the state, and you'll soon realize that something is wrong with the way we mete out justice. We probably have a lot of criminals in Indian country, is one of the assumptions you may have. Or we've got an excellent, superior law enforcement machine working in Indian country. Or there are some imbalances in that scale of justice. I would submit the letter to you for your consideration. And I want to say some things tonight which will help you understand how that imbalance of justice is created and carried out in this country. In Sioux Falls, South Dakota, 40% of that institution, the state prison of South Dakota, is Indian people. You can go any place in and around Indian country and find out that the same things are happening. You find out Deer Lodge, Montana, the same way. In Colorado, the youth facility at Englewood, Colorado, is the same way. That's of no concern, it seems, to the administrators of those institutions. And all of those institutions in 1968 and 1969 came forth with a new wave of asserting themselves as Indian people within the context of a prison. And at that time, they were known as culture groups, classes, and so forth. Those same movements happen on campuses throughout the country. And we now have departments and divisions of Indian studies throughout the country. But in prison, it took on a different style. And in Stillwater, we had a class there in 1961 or two. I wasn't at the prison then, but it was structured by Eddie Benton Benet, and it lasted a couple of years before it was phased out. But I was there when we revived that concept in 1967. And some of the things we went through are pretty terrible. We would have to get 10 people before we could go up into a room and dance or listen to a tape recorder with Indian music on it or make beadwork. All kinds of things were happening to us, and we couldn't understand why people didn't want us to be Indian. We couldn't exercise our Indianness within those prisons. We weren't very sophisticated in our organizing methods. We were just dumb Indians trying to exercise our will and desire. And I went through that until I was released in November of 1969. And when I got out, one of my commitments was that I should go back and I should be a person on the street. who would help those groups back in Stillwater and in St. Cloud. And I tried to do that, but the wardens of those institutions wouldn't let me do that. So I start sending supplies and money in with other people, not money in the prison, but money to buy other things for those people in prison. And that's when I began, when I started what was called the Indian Offender Rehabilitation Project. That would take Indian people out and have other Indian people working with them on their release from prison. We wanted to demonstrate to an effective level that Indian people working with other Indian people could more effectively create some degree of success with respect to recidivism. Recidivism has haunted criminal justice people throughout the ages since prisons began. And the most recent numbers that I can find is that 65% of all those released from prison return within 5 years. That's, if you were selling cars that way and 65% of them came back to you, you know, there's something wrong with that. Or anything for that matter. So we have a machine or a system that's malfunctioning. Its products are faulty and need repair. And they come back two and three times and four times for repair. Sometimes come back until they expire. Well, looking at the surface of the situation, I learned that somehow there has to be a group organized to do some things for Indians. We went to the Commissioner of Corrections. We structured an advisory committee for Indian concerns. Well, it seems to me that advice is sometimes taken and sometimes it's not. So we went from that to a more effective thing called a task force, which we set before us some very concrete goals to meet. And those were in terms of funding and programming and organizing people. We did that very well. In 1972, we hired, and that was myself, the first Indian planner in the Department of Corrections. That year, we funded $500,000 worth of programs in the corrections department alone, specifically for Indian people. Those had to do with culture classes at institutions, halfway houses and group homes for Native American people being released from institutions. We're now using those as an alternative to incarceration. But I want to, those are just some of the limited things that we've done. And the point that I want to make throughout that, telling you about that, is that all of those ideas and concepts were implemented and developed by Native American people. There was no non-Indian person who put a pen to paper in writing any one of those programs. There was no non-Indian people who worked and organized and developed. We used non-Indian money, however. Now, if we can, with our unskilled minds, do that much in so short of a time, that seems to me to be a credible, accountable device. I want to tell you about the Anishinaabe Longhouse also, before we get into some of the causes of what we call criminal activity amongst Native American people. At the Anishinaabe Longhouse, we have eight people working, and with exceptions of one counselor, community worker, and one secretary the staff is all Indian. So we have Indian people working with Indians. We have a council which functions as a quasi-board of directors. It does not function along the lines of Robert's Rules of Order or any of those parliamentary procedures. We meet and discuss and hammer out solutions to whatever problems we may be experiencing. I'm the director of that facility. I have been since it started. I developed it from an idea and implemented and evaluating it. It's not a one-man show. It's just one person coordinating the affairs of all the people involved in it. So that's the kind of the short history of that program. But now when it's being evaluated now by the Crime Commission, that program stands number one in the state of Minnesota with respect to recidivism. That program stands number one in the state of Minnesota with respect to program completions. Two of the highly sought after goals of anybody involved in community-based corrections. And we ask, the question is always asked, how do you do it? It gives me a hard time to bring out that answer clearly and concisely and to the point. It's damn near impossible to do. And I'll tell you why. While we can understand each other as people, we cannot understand each other about where we came from and what we are. The non-Indians have assumed that we should fit into the frame of reference of the European style of living and believing and motivations. And for 500 years, that has failed. You know, to me, it seems as if that thing wouldn't work over 20 or 30 years, I'd kind of give up on it and try some other way. But we keep pounding at the same thing for 500 years and we're still doing it today. That's incredible. I want to see people try new ideas. I want to see people live life as they perceive it in their dreams and in their families and how they ought to live, not as how the guy lives across the street. I'd like to see that incorporated somehow into our institutions so that we can be free about life and not confined and not conforming to that which hasn't worked. I sit in my office and people don't come to see me. They call me up. How does your program work? And my supervisors and their supervisors are always asking for your goals and objectives, your progress, and it really drives people goofy if they can read something that justifies their position, not mine, not my clients, not my staff. It seems as though that is secondary or less of a priority. We need to know that when we address Native American people, that we are in contact with a unique kind of people. We're not Swedes, we're not Norwegians, we're not black. We're a minority. And we need to be talked to and dealt with all the respect and dignity that you would treat your own family. Not as your puppy dog, not as a recipient of any condescending attitudes or paternalistic attitudes. but with respect and dignity. I command that from people. I want that from people. And I work hard for it. But I've come off on my knees, and I think a lot of other Indian people have also come off on their knees. And they can speak to you as the possessors of intelligence and knowledge and expertise about how to deal with the so-called Indian problems. Tradition is well built into Anishinaabe Longhouse. We exercise Native American tradition. And above all else, we exercise Native American religion. In the ceremonies, we don't play act. We don't pretend. Those are real ceremonies. But those are the things that I can't write about. Those are things I can't take pictures of. Those are things I can't videotape or even tape on a tape recorder. I can't do that. I'm instructed not to, but I can use it for Indian people. That's the hard part of our joining together in trying to come up with a solution so that we can handle Native American people in the system of justice that we have. Now I want to take you as an Indian person, how they feel through the criminal justice system. I want to take you as a youth who doesn't find anything meaningful in school, who would rather go out of school and do something else and to use his imagination. He cuts classes. He's late for school. Indian people are great for being late. School social workers try to deal with that behavior of a person, an Indian person who does that. And I don't understand why he's so quiet, why he doesn't say anything, why he doesn't open up. The only thing he does is act out in a belligerent manner. Well, they give up very soon on him, and they call the court services in. We have this person who is really giving us a bad time. So put him into a courtroom with a referee who says, well, we can't have this, so we're going to put you on probation for 3 days or 4 days. He lasts one day and he's back in the courtroom. From there, he goes to a group home probably. More than likely, he'll go to an institution. Beginning of the long trip through the system. And the people who do the workups in the base files about what Indian people are not basing their opinions, and they're not analyzing the substance before them from a perspective which would deal with the client or with the individual. They're analyzing it from the other side, like from the bench looking down on you. And it's hard to come up with anything useful in that manner. The only useful things you come up with are how to maintain a bureaucracy, of how to keep it intact, of how to maintain your job as a social worker, a probation officer, or a court worker. You see, there's a hidden machine in there that keeps that beast alive, that defunct piece of machinery that is no good for the client. It's only feeding itself. That's the juvenile system. Because the juvenile system is such a failure, we just crank out and we pass it on. We kind of leave it for somebody else to inherit. Then it becomes the adult system. And the adult system runs the same game of numbers on you. By that time, you're so programmed and so skillful at telling people what they want to hear, and that is the name of the game, is telling people what they want to hear, so they can keep their jobs and they can feel good about themselves and they can go home and smile at their wife and children and go out for picnics while you rot and stink in a cell. Well, who cares? That happens to all races of people, but it happens more often to Indians than any other group. And it happens with the severity. I want to tell you something right now. I want to tell you about what's happening at Stillwater. I also want you to know that I was an investigator for the Joint Legislative Committee to investigate the prison in the month of July, the first part of August. And what I'm going to tell you now is probably a matter of record anyway. But today, there are 20 Indians out of the 70 who are in maximum security in a prison. And what are they for? Suspected of drinking. No due process. We put them in the back end and you can stay a year in C maximum security. 1 year where they pump daylight back to you. They have 36 units in that C maximum security unit. 27 of those are livable units, so you can only get 27 men in there. 10 of those men are Indian people. So half of the people in the back end are Indians. So the further back you go, you know, you go into the prison world, the more Indians are going to find. And, you know, if we had it any further back, I'm sure you'd find that if you went back far enough, you'd find that they'd be all Indians pretty soon. Keeps getting, the more you go into the woods, the more Indians you're going to find. And in Doghouse, you also have 10 Indian people in there. So that's part of them are back there too. It's not so bad as the other place. You got some daylight over there. At one time, a year ago in November, they locked every Indian up in St. Cloud because of an incident in the chapel. You see, that's the only plan that we have in the criminal justice world, is to lock people up. And you can't steal their minds. You can't, I guess you can do it in a certain way which leads people to buy out of the whole mess by committing suicide. But you know, Indian people are stronger the harder it gets in there because of those culture groups, because of the coalescing of those people who find themselves in a bad light. You know, we always mention the high rate of suicide among Indian people throughout the nation, the highest of any group of people. But yet, over the past 15 years in prison, where it's the most vicious of all, I've only known one Indian to commit suicide out of the hundreds who went through there. So there is strength within the people there. And there's a togetherness, even though it's probably not in the right place. Our system has to change. That's for sure. We know that. It has to change. But in which way will it go? We look at the contemporary scene of politics, about what we now have is an indeterminate sentence for all people. This is due to the 1963 code revision, which says you will be 0 to 20 for aggravated robbery, 0 to 10 for simple robbery, 0 to 7 for rape, or whatever the crime is, there's a 0 to a limit. By the way, in my case, I got a 0 to 20. I thought I'd have to do the whole 20. But anyway, We now have what we call the determinate sentence. That's coming before the legislature for some kind of consideration. I'm not sure it'll even be partially addressed in this year's meeting. But it's the ebb and flow of liberal, conservative, dark, light, the whole thing that keeps this world alive, I guess, is to change it. Even if it doesn't need changing, we'll change it anyway. But the thing that I want to say about determinate sentencing is that it's going to find a heck of a lot more Indian people in jail than there are now, and in prisons than there are now. That's my belief, and I can support that easily. Using the department's own research division to do it. They've got the numbers on it of how many convictions, arrests, and so forth are coming down. Part of that system is pure out-and-out racism. The other part of it has to do with ignorance, and somehow those two are sometimes distinctly apart, and other times they're pretty much together. But I want to tell you about some people in Cass Lake who leave the prison. On their orders, they are not to return to the Leech Lake area. You know, we have a system of justice which deals in primarily four areas here. We have prevention, juvenile, then we have the courts, the police, and corrections. That's the justice system that I see. And from a judge sentencing you, he turns you over to, well, first of all, you come up through the juvenile justice system. Then it's usually law enforcement grabs a hold of you as an adult, takes you to the courts. The courts do their thing with you, and then they give you into the hands of corrections. But that's not so anymore. That was the idea when it was started. But right now, the police follow you all the way through that. And they keep your number. They know where you're at and when you're getting released. And the police tell the judge that, hey, old Joe Jones here, he's getting out after only 7 years. What's wrong with your court? And then the courts get nervous about it, and they bring grievances against the Department of Corrections for releasing people too soon. Ruining the whole thing that we created the indeterminate sentence for. So we have mass confusion in our own systems, which will not let authorities exercise their duly delegated authority. And that's what comes about when Indian people try to go back to Cass Lake. They can't go back. We take people out, we don't care really where they're from. The only crime at the longhouse that we have any serious objection to would be a crime which involved a sexual crime of sorts, whether it be rape or indecent liberties, or whether it involved a child, and we won't consider those. But other crimes, we will. And a lot of times people come to us, and after their stay with us, they go back to the reservation. And to us, it's okay. We understand that. That's their home. But yet, the system tends to take away their home. So you're really, in fact, being sentenced to a life sentence. You haven't served your time in taking your pound of flesh from a person and setting him out free again. That's not really the case at all. We carry that burden for a long time. Even myself. I've been pardoned by the governor and the attorney general and chief justice. This happened in November. That was kind of my reward for losing my school board election. Yeah. Anyway, you know, there's very few Indians who go through that system, you know, and can appreciate any freedom at all at the other end of it. There's no appreciate any freedom at all at the other end of it. There's no forgiveness. There's no restoration of faith in you. And I wanted to make some comments on the makeup of Native American people and how they go into the system. And there are so many things that are unanswered yet today. For example, I'm sure that there are no Indian people in prison in the state of Minnesota over 40 years old. You can go check that one out if you want to. I'm sure there are probably only 6 or 7 over 35 years old. And there's probably no more than a dozen over. There is something that happens within people, which after they get beat up enough, and I really don't know what happens, but they don't go back to prison anymore. But it's really nothing that the prison teaches them. It isn't a rehabilitation that prison has. It's probably just a way of learning how to survive a little better in this world. You know, I look at justice and I see the people who are marching around Washington, Colson's, Halderman, Dean, Stans, Mitchell, Magruder. Well, hell, I could sing all night long here, those guys. But they, you know, those guys combined, all of those guys combined, I got more time than they have in the joint. And I stole $33. You know, that something really is wrong. And as long as we say, so what? Then we need to live with the problem. We don't have to understand it. But as an Indian person, as only one person who came out of a dismal scene where there was no Indian programs, there was no Indian nothing, we made something. An Indian community made something because it had the guts to get up and do it. No longer talking about it. Don't waste time talking about it. But do something with it. You know, you look in the past of how prisons were developed in this country, about the Christian thought behind those prisons, about the penance you would have to do. And it was a wildfire. It got away from somebody. Then we needed to modify that. It cost money to have those things, so let's have those convicts working. We'll put those convicts to work. We can't just support them in there. So we got another kind of penitentiary or prison, as you call it, where people would work. That's largely what we have today. We kind of outgrew that old idea. It didn't work, you know. Well, how long are we going to let the present system fail before we try another one? Maybe we'll go back to the old one and try that one again. But evolution takes hold in anything, wherever you're at. And I would like to be a part of the future. The people here can do a job too, you know. You cannot stand by and watch the thing go by. You've got to hop on and take a ride with it. And in studying prisons, you have to know more than what people tell you about prisons. In order to get that kind of an education, you have to look very closely at and measure the effectiveness of that system. Go to a courtroom someday. Sit in a courtroom in Minneapolis, in the government center. Go look at the elevator. See what kind of people get on that elevator. You're not going to find a guy getting on that elevator who has a nice top coat on and a hat and pretty well dressed. You're not going to see him getting on that elevator. But you're going to see poor white people getting on that elevator. And behind them are going to come Native Americans and black people and Asian people and Chicano people. So that gives you some indication of justice. And we've got a long way to go before we even get at a basic of developing justice in this country. You would expect me to get my people together to appreciate justice as it is and change the system, get within it and change it. Well, I'm tired of that baloney too. But look, people have to look at themselves. I can't change anybody's mind. They got to change it themselves. You know, some things that really have to happen, and so much of this is escaping me tonight, to how I could, the thoughts I could leave you with, in terms of setting out on a course which would make an attempt at creating justice. Because I'll stick by my belief that we don't have justice. That only the rich and the powerful have any sort of justice. How do we allow that to develop? There are differences in people that are not understood, that have nothing to do really with law, that really have to do with nature and the world about us. How would I create a system that would treat us all fairly? One of the first things I would do would be to ask for repeal of a couple of million of the laws that we now have on the books, which are so indecent to people that the only time they're exercised is to suppress people. That maybe I'd put the Native American somewhere in the Constitution. That maybe I'd look at the Bill of Rights and other than calling an Indian a savage, I'd call him a Native American and give him a little dignity. I'd include him in the laws of this land. And when I talk about civil rights, I'd look at the Native American people for what they have as a nation, for what they have learned and will continue to possess in intelligence about how to deal with this country. But they were not mentioned in our developing civil rights laws of the 1950s throughout 64 and 65. They weren't in there. We weren't even citizens until 1924. So how can we gripe? You know, how do criminal justice people deal with us who are living in a multi-governmental shadow of the state and of the federal and the county? Of what is public law 280? What does that mean to you? Do you understand what Public Law 280 brought to this country, this state, where we were all wards of the federal government until Public Law 280 gave us the option to vote by referendum on each reservation whether we wanted to retain federal embrace or whether we wanted to subject ourselves to state jurisdiction? Sixth reservation in this state chose to go the way of the state. Red Lake did not. How about the Wheeler-Howard Act, structuring tribal councils on reservations and elected people? No longer did we have the council of hereditary chiefs, but we had a Mickey Mouse government structured by a foreign nation on our land and in our world. That's wrong. That's all wrong. Who studies those points of interest and of difference? And who gives them any credibility at all in the meaning of law of this country? Why was it that Indian people could carry out their lifestyle relatively crime-free, where we didn't have the jails and the detox centers and the policemen and social workers, caseworkers and prison guards and wardens? You know, we can find out a lot from that if we'd let ourselves do it. But you see, we told a big lie back in 1492, I think it was, October sometime. And somebody had to tell the second lie to cover up the first lie. And we continue to do that. We continue to lie about what this country is. And we look at our own state of Minnesota and all of the things that we've done wrong, but we will not admit that we've taken the whole state and raped it for all its natural resources, feeling no shame about that. And we let the big giant sit up there on the North Shore still doing it today. The country is lazy. The people are disinterested. We're trying to find a convenient way to bring justice to everybody. We're looking for a miracle. And a miracle is nowhere but within yourselves. Just like myself, I waited for nearly 30 years for somebody to come by and save me from this awful mess that I had gotten myself into. I had only myself to do, and only a limited amount of resources. I always mention that, $97 what I left prison with, you know, and tried to do something with it. But now we've looked at the needs. How does one come up with the ideas? Where do you go for advice, and where do you go for knowledge? You know, if you really want to know about bullfighting, I would think you'd want to go talk to a bullfighter. And if you want to know about automobiles, you'd go talk to a guy who either drives one or has to work on one. And if you want to know about crime, you either go talk to the victim or you talk to the person who perpetrated the crime. You don't talk to somebody 40 miles away who heard about it and got a written report about it. To me, that's the heart of the problem. We have people planning and prioritizing our needs in the criminal justice system and corrections, sitting in a building in St. Paul, what we call the central office, and the damn thing doesn't even have windows so you can't see out of it, and they're completely removed from the scene of activity. They have divided that prison so many times, both prisons. They've reorganized. Since I've been there, I've had four different commissioners and probably a dozen deputy commissioners. They all play musical chairs every 18 months or so. We still don't get any results out of those people, and they all get from $24,000 to $30,000 a year. Current going prices, they'll go up 4% on the 30th of January. To me, you need to go out into communities where crime is happening. You have to understand the motivations of crime and why crime is. Native American people are being locked up at a larger proportion than other people because, I'll tell you why right now. It's because we don't have any credit, It's because we don't have any employment. It's because we don't have any education. It's because we don't have any references. It's because we haven't lived in the same place over 1 year. 5 easy reasons why we're being locked up, but nobody wants to deal with them. Nobody will deal with them but Indian people. And why do we have those unemployment, uneducated people? You know, you can keep going back. What came first, the chicken or the egg? It's that kind of an evolution. And we keep copping out to somebody else. You know, we have no Indian people working in the criminal justice system to any appreciable amount. We have maybe 10 people throughout, 1,400 people working for the Department of Corrections. Court services in Minneapolis have got about 3 or 4 probation officer aides working on CEDA-funded positions, which means at the end of the year they go. We don't have any people entrenched in our education systems. They're all working on federal dollars. As soon as the federal dollars go, that's the first thing to go on the budget cuts. While politicians talk about budget cuts, the people I want to cut are superintendents and assistants, assistant principals, coordinators of space. Those are the people I want to send out looking for work. If I were to cut budgets, I would not cut the social worker aides or the people who really deal with the child in the classroom or deal with the juvenile delinquent on the street. Those are the people I want to preserve because they're doing the work. And that's the system of justice that I see. But you know, there's a difference between what I see and between what politicians see. So what do you do with the ideas and the plans, and how do you implement them? I can only do, as one person, relatively little in the whole scene. But each person as a voter needs to instigate some kind of, or at least provoke some kind of thought within their congressman, their senator, or their legislator in their communities. And they have to ask the questions. If that disturbs you enough. If it doesn't, then you need to prepare and toughen your hide to a lot of sob stories and tears and suicides in the system of justice that we see today. You know, when people watch other people, they have some strange behavior. They suddenly start doing things right. I don't know what it is that does it to people, but they cleaned up that prison in such a hurry in July when we began the investigation. And they started treating people better. They got a food service in there now. They hired a company from St. Paul, which brings the food to the prisoners in Stillwater. This is the 9th legislative investigation to go to Stillwater. This is going to be the 9th failure. I resigned from that investigation, primarily because I could not see eye to eye with the chief counsel and how he conducted the investigation. I think he's doing a good job for Consemius and Mo. I think he's working for the committee, and that's where he owes his allegiance. He and I differed because I worked for the people, and he worked for the money and the politicians. That's That's where he has to survive. But the points that I raised in the investigation were some of the things I said here tonight. I said, why are Indian people being beaten up in sea segregation? Why are people being denied their constitutional rights with respect to religion, their equal rights in terms of human rights? Why is one group allowed to bring wine into the prison for ceremonial purposes when Native American people cannot have tobacco and a pipe in there for the same expression of religious belief? And why is a drum locked up from people, the Native American drum locked up, when you have stereos competing against each other in the cell block, where the noise is just unbelievable? It really is. All of those points are raised. You know, I even experienced some of the harassment at the front gate myself and wrote reports on that, which were all put aside by saying that, Mr. Pupart, we can't go about changing people's minds. We can't go about restructuring the prison. All we have to do is make legislative recommendations. And, you know, I couldn't believe that, and I still don't believe that that will happen for the people who it really needs to happen. That whole investigation was set off because an Indian person was killed, was butchered on the second gallery of A House. And we can't convict anybody for that. Just deal with what the circumstances are. Another person was skillfully executed in Doghouse. Those are things that push that investigation, but the investigation will continue to treat things with a mild manner, to retain the same warden at the prison, and not hold him responsible, nor will they hold the commissioner responsible for those actions. Now, I can't agree with those findings. I think that if I did, I would probably be one of the lazy people. I would say, I'm drawing my paychecks, or what the heck, you know. I won't risk anything. But I did. The only thing I think I made a mistake in not announcing the resignation with the impact, and creating the impact that I should have. I failed to do that for some other considerations. I was in a political environment, and I chose not to do that. But I think all of you should keep that in mind as you're going to read about the report which will be coming out. And it'll sound good, but I'm sure that no new legislation will come out and will effectuate any changes in the prison. They're not even decided whether they'll close the prison or they'll close the reformatory. They was going to close the reformatory last year. They just brought 150 people down from that reformatory, so they're going to remodel it. So what I'm saying is, from a personal point of view and from one who is closely associated with those scenes, is that we have mass confusion in our correctional institutions in Minnesota. That probably wouldn't rest too well with the commissioner, but I don't know what he's going to do about it. And maybe by me speaking out publicly on it, something will be done. And I may pay that price for it. I want to take a couple of minutes, 5 or 10 minutes, to respond to any questions or listen to any comments that you may have about what I've said tonight. Is there anybody awake out there yet?
Yeah. get any thoughts about what the product is? Between the old way of life, like, say, 200 years ago, Indians and the present day American society, maybe this isn't your forte.
Yeah, I kind of dig what you're saying. It's institutions are, institutional thought is primarily what guides us all in modern day society. And whatever area you're in, there are certain things you need to conform to and certain values that are established in mores that that control the masses. I don't really disagree with that for those who can apply themselves to it and can identify with it. The conflict arises when people have not had the opportunity to buy into that system, in particular Native American people. They've never been given the opportunity to honorably buy into that system. They've been asked to sell out to that system. And they have never been treated with the respect of their position, whatever it may be in the Indian society. So 200 years ago, we practiced medicine and our own way of religion. 200 years later, today, although you don't know it, I know it. I practice that same religion. I exercise the same rights. I still believe in that. Can you understand what I'm saying? That I haven't sold out. I've bought into white society, and I take it for what it's worth. Not all our people can understand and can enable themselves to do that. So they're continually involving themselves on the bad side of something. They're always arguing with that system or that institution. So yes and no, I answer the question. But I can't speak for very many people.
Yeah. Trying to follow. Well, do you think that it presents a major problem of maintaining Indian culture and as far as attitudes towards, the typical Anglo-Saxon American culture as far as I do this in within society because society wants me to do this, but I really have second thoughts about this. Is it a problem to avoid selling out without making some concessions to the society? Do you think it's possible to make concessions to the society without selling out? Just to do something for the sake of becoming accepted within the society?
No, I don't give a damn if you or anybody else in this room accepts me. But I have something to say, and I've established myself a platform from which I can say that. And that has come through some effort. The thing you address from the perspective that you address it from indicates, or at least suggests to me, that your mind is still following what other people have been doing to us as people. You talk from your side and asking me to buy your side, never giving honor to my side in forming any kind of relationship. You're like a jealous wife, you know. It's all my way or none at all.
I disagree with you on that point.
Jealous wife to boot.
No. I see your point, but I maintain my own. But I don't think that we have a accurate understanding of each other.
Okay, take it from my side once.
Right, okay.
Yes?
I want to know if there were any noticeable differences when you said that six or seven tribes in Minnesota voted to remain wards of the state, one tribe decided not to, in your whole criminal thing that you're talking about, are there any appreciable differences in the tribe that decided to become independent?
Yes, there are. Well, they're not tribes, they're bands. They're all the Minnesota Chippewa tribe. I'm not speaking about the Upper and Lower Sioux, Prairie Island, or Shakopee. I'm not dealing with the four Sioux communities. I'm talking about the six reservations, Chippewa reservations, and the one which is also Chippewa, Red Lake. Red Lake is the one which did not go under state jurisdiction. So the distinctions are, in terms of criminal justice, that Red Lake juvenile people generally will be sent to Wahpeton or one of the close federal youth homes around Minnesota, or they'll go to Englewood, Colorado, which is the youth detention center. And other people will go to the more advanced, the adult, what we term adult, would go to probably Terre Haute or Leavenworth or someplace like that further away. I believe, and it's only my opinion, based on my observations and involvement with the Red Lake people, that Red Lake people seem to be more closely knit than the other tribes or the bands in Minnesota. I know that their own economic development is much more superior than any of the other reservations have, primarily because they do have direct federal support. And most other reservations have to go through the state or some other intermediary, to the Bureau of Indian Affairs, to their own conglomerate, which is the Minnesota Chippewa Tribe, to establish any kind of economic development on their reservations. So there are distinctions, and I don't know which one is, excuse me, which one is any better. They are different.
Yeah, I guess I would hope that some sociological things would emerge that through independence, that you would see some trends that they were handling their own situations, or that was a lower crime rate, or there's not any real trends like that.
Oh, I don't have access to any records of Red Lake. Red Lake goes through the United States Bureau of Prisons. While I do take clients from the U.S. Bureau of Prisons, I do not have open access to their research files, such as I do in the Department of Corrections, which is state operated. Usually, it's very hard to an area to refine it down to an area in terms of research from the federal government, because they are so broad. It's, you know, they handle things all over the 50 states. Yes.
My religion tells me that I am supposed to stand with the poor and oppressed. Now, how, from a person, I am not poor or oppressed, you know, thank God for financial aid, or I wouldn't be
okay
here, but, you know, what would the Indian perspective be on that? You know, what would you have to suggest to me for my lifestyle from a person who is poor and oppressed?
Heck, I wouldn't want to rule over anybody,
no,
but I would suggest that if you wanted to help me, you would indeed help me. You wouldn't lead me, but you would help me. And you would let me decide what my issues were, what my priorities were, and you could help me manage with the existing systems that you know about in communities or wherever, whatever experience you have, you could bring that to me to help. And that's really where I see Native American people at, in terms of their self-determination of bringing our own lifestyles to the front, so that people can take from that on an even exchange what is good for them, but don't steal it and don't crush it, but treat it with great respect. Okay.
Any people who are
No. What I said was that we didn't want to accept those people in that house at this particular time, and I'll tell you why. It has to do with community attitudes. It has to do with public relations. And certainly, when I went into the North Minneapolis community, the people didn't want me there. I fought very hard. I looked at 89. That was the 89th house I looked at and tried to get into. People, first of all, didn't want ex-convicts. They didn't want Indians. And we have a large drinking problem with Indians now. You know, all of those factors, and there was a lot of ignorance amongst the black people in North Minneapolis about Native Americans. There was, not too many years ago, the riots of the North Side because, and there was a tremor of some jealousy in there because people, while it was okay to have all black, it wasn't okay to have all Indian. That kind of threatened that position. So, and the people who were raising the most cane about it were people who were intermarried black and white marriages of about 13 years ago, when the community at that point was largely a Jewish community. So, and then black people more densely populated the area. So it had its own transition and short-lived tradition. And we seemed to be interlopers in that. And suggestions were made that we may be a detriment to the community because we'd bring crime, we'd bring shooting, we'd bring booze and dope, and illicit sex, and you know, all of the things that people aren't used to dealing with. And I fought the people in the best way I knew how, was political, was to jam the damn thing down their throats and let them live with us for 6 months, and at the end of 6 months, if they still felt and could document their beliefs, then I would move out. And the fears didn't materialize. So that's where we came in with, because we have in that community a couple of churches very close to us, and we have daycare centers, and we have group homes very close. We didn't want to set up a situation where somebody could have an opportunity to create our demise. We aren't equipped in any manner to deal with sexual deviants. I don't know how to do that. I think maybe psychologists, psychiatrists, or some people who can work with the mind have that knowledge, but we don't. We only work with normal people who are put in an abnormal situation. I don't know, because I don't have anything to back me up for learning. I don't know about that. You see, so I'm caught short, and if I can't deal with it honestly and with some good effort behind it, then I'm acting very foolishly. I'm risking somebody else's safety due to my ignorance. So the best thing to do is to admit my ignorance, and maybe someday somebody will come along and say, I know how to deal with that problem. But for the time being, we just have to not allow people with those crimes into the program. There was somebody else here. Yeah.
You made a point that American society has forced Indians to deal with it on their own terms and in the terms of white people. And a lot of problems come when Indians try to be white, yet they deny that sort of position at the same time. And do you ever find that Indian offenders are hesitant to enter into a program like the Longhouse because it's a type of program where they're responsible for their own health using Indian ways rather than the white ways that they've always been told to rely on.
Yeah. You know, when you deal with criminal minds, I'm no criminologist or penologist or any of those people who have studied for a long time about him. I just know him because I lived with him longer than they studied about him. So I know something about him. Is that the criminal mind always wants to take a shortcut. And let me tell you something about the Anishinaabe Longhouse is a shortcut. It's a restoration of somebody's dignity without him having to toil for it. We give that back to them, or we say it's available, because it's not ours to give or take. It's ours to indicate that it's there, that the pride for yourself and your responsibility for your own action is within yourself, not within any other authority. But if you don't make those decisions for yourself, somebody else is going to make the decision for you. And that's just as clear as if I were talking to one of my clients right now. It's very simple. And people who want to take the shortcut can suddenly realize that, geez, I'm really not such a bad guy after all, you know. Despite all they've been telling me about how bad I really am, I'm worth something. And somebody's telling me that and showing me. And I'm exercising that. So that makes a person come to life. That's where our success ratio is based, by letting people know that they are free and that they are worth something. That's just the ignition it takes. You know, instead of me standing by the door counting time you come in or the time you go out, I put that in the clients themselves. They violate that. They don't violate my law. They don't violate any statute I've created. They violate something else, and that's the trust to themselves. And that's more terrible to live with. And when you meet that and you encounter that, you have to deal with it with all you've got, and you really have to dig deep for some stuff. It's therapy. It really is. But so far, we haven't got it programmed. And I say so far with some apprehension, because I don't think it should be programmed. I don't really think it should. I think people ought to live and be free. No more questions? One more, and then we're going to go, okay? Pardon? No, I don't have children. I have grown men there. They're all bandits and robbers. No, they go to any place they want it. We don't differentiate. See, the thing we do is we are not, let me make this very clear before we leave, is that the Anishinaabe Longhouse is not a separatist, isolated unit, and that will always be Indian amongst Indian. We'll all travel in Indian stuff. We're not that. All we're doing is preparing Indian people to know themselves better so they can deal with their surroundings. That's all we're doing. Sure, they can go any place. We take them over there. We give them a ride too if they want to go. Okay? Listen, thank you. You've all been such a very nice audience.